The secretary was not aware that Alaska was seeing marine debris coming to its shore and wasn't certain what was going on with the agencies.
Making the case for marine debris cleanup funding in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, preserving a subsistence way of life in rural Alaska.
That's why I don't go for food stamps, to teach my grandkids how to try and survive on their own.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The U.S. House passed a bill today to fund the Marine Debris Program, the federal entity that will coordinate the cleanup as trash from the Japanese tsunami washes ashore. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the bill is stalled in the Senate.
The Marine Debris Program has enjoyed bipartisan support since Senators Ted Stevens and Daniel Inouye initially introduced it. The House quickly passed a reauthorization Wednesday night. In fact, there was so much support, it passed by a voice vote, meaning the entire House did not vote on it, just the handful in the chamber. The House bill would spend nearly $5 million per year on the Marine Debris Program, while the Senate plan would double that. It would also add specific language about tsunami debris. That means the two bills will have to be reconciled with one another. Senator Mark Begich says that should not be a problem.
People understand you have this kind of, it sounds odd, but to say normal debris, you know, that we've been dealing with for years, and then these catastrophic situations that occur, I think people recognize those bring in a different kind of requirement of coordination between the different agencies and so forth in a very fast way.
But the future of the Senate bill is unclear. At least one senator placed a hold on this particular bill. Any senator can place a hold on any bill for any reason anonymously. The Conservative Republican Steering Committee places holds on all sorts of bills. It's chaired by South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint, who says he does not remember if he put a hold on the marine debris bill.
I'm not sure about that one. That may be something that a lot of times we'll hold bills they're trying to pass by unanimous consent just so we can read them.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is urging for a working group of federal agencies. She says last week she met with Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar to discuss the problem.
The secretary was not aware that Alaska was seeing marine debris coming to its shore and wasn't certain what was going on with the agencies.
Senator Murkowski says that working groups in Washington don't tend to move quickly, but the agencies need to know what one another is doing. She adds that both the federal government and state will have to pitch in, both in manpower and financially. Elaine Bussey Floyd is with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. She prepared the state application for a $50,000 grant for tsunami cleanup from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
We didn't designate a specific area, but it'll either be in South Central or the Gulf of Alaska. And we'll pinpoint that down once we actually have the money in our hand. Simultaneously now, I'm preparing a scope of work to put out so we can solicit proposals, so we can contract that and turn on a dime as soon as NOAA gives us approval.
The executive branch of the federal government, the Department of Interior and others, could grant more money. But Senator Murkowski says a congressional reauthorization for the Marine Debris Program is the best first step to getting more. With time running out in the congressional session, it's looking tight. Senator Begich says he remains optimistic.
I have seen things here on a Friday when we're closing out sessions, multiple bills move suddenly through that have UCs on them, unanimous consent, or they're moving forward because all the holds have been lifted suddenly. So you don't know until really the session is fully over, which won't be till December.
And by then, the cleanup effort will be that much harder in constant dark and cold. And there's no indication that a gridlocked Congress will come back after an election and decide to cooperate. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A U.S. House committee passed an amendment to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act this morning that would force the government to recognize Alexander Creek as an Alaska Native village under ANCSA. Alexander Creek, northwest of Anchorage in the Matsu Borough, is part of Cook Inlet Regional Incorporated. If it passes, Alexander Creek would incorporate itself, and residents would receive smaller Siri dividends, with the rest of the money going to the village corporation, which would decide how it would be distributed. The bill would require the U.S. government to settle land claim issues with Alexander Creek leaders by the end of this year. But that depends on passage. Congress is slated to begin a five-week recess this weekend. When it returns in September, they'll have to work on more pressing legislation to avoid across-the-board spending cuts and a plan to keep funding the government for about 6 months. All of that within 2 months of the election. Siri officials did not make themselves available for comment, but in written testimony, they were against the current proposal, citing concerns over land rights issues and other problems they felt would infringe on Siri's holdings. More ships than ever are operating in the Bering Strait and off the north coast of Alaska, but many of the nautical charts for the region haven't been updated in more than a century. Now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is trying to fix that. The research vessel Fairweather set off today for a surveying trip in the Arctic. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
On the back deck of the 231-foot Fairweather, Operations Officer Karen Zacharias is showing off a 10-foot-long piece of equipment that looks like a torpedo with wings.
We can fly this fish. We also fly the smaller fish, the 5,000.
The fish is a side-scan sonar. Like all sonar, it works by bouncing sound off of a target and then measuring the echoes that come back. In this case, the target is the seafloor, and the echoes paint a picture of its topography. The side scan is one of several instruments the crew of the Fairweather will be using as they trace a path from Kotzebue to the Canadian border over the next month. It's the first mapping expedition of the North Coast using modern equipment.
I mean, I think we're probably a little behind the curve right now, but we're trying to understand what we need to do to get that data for the Mariner.
That was Fairweather Commander James Crocker. He says the main problem is that existing charts aren't detailed enough.
Now, you have a lot of barge traffic that goes up there to support the communities. They kind of know where they can go. They know their margin station, how to operate. But as you start looking at, you know, more potential for ecotourism, you start getting container ships or you get any type of bulk carriers or oil or whatever it is, that local knowledge isn't going to be there to guide them through the waters.
Crocker adds that many of the charts are also inaccurate, since they rely on data gathered using less precise instruments.
On the chart, it may say you can get within a mile or so, but that's based on data from 1890 or, you know, who knows exactly when.
Although this summer, the Fairweather won't be collecting the detailed data NOAA needs to actually update the charts, Crocker says the trip will provide a baseline for future mapping expeditions, or could show that the information is already available.
For this specific project, though, we are just doing a reconnaissance that will allow us to compare our data to some outside data to see whether we can help utilize that and bring in other information onto the chart that may be there and to determine if it meets the standards that we need for nautical charting purposes.
The Fairweather will concentrate on areas close to the shoreline, especially the heavily trafficked zones near Point Hope and Barrow. Crocker hopes to make it all the way to the Canadian border, but that might not be possible because of persistent ice cover in the Beaufort Sea. If that's the case, he says there's plenty of work to be done elsewhere, including right here in Unalaska. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Wrangell contemplates the benefits of converting wood waste to heating fuel.
Keeping funds in your community and paying yourself for creating energy versus paying out of the community for energy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Some Alaska communities are pushing back against a new requirement that ships sailing within 200 miles of the coast burn cleaner fuel. They say the rule, which goes into effect today, will hurt cruise traffic and increase shipping costs. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Tourism dominates Skagway's summer economy, so it's no surprise many there oppose the new fuel rules.
It takes years to get a cruise line, and it takes a second to drive one away.
That's Steve Heitz, owner of the Skagway Streetcar Company and a member of the town's Port Commission. He's telling Skagway's assembly about new air emission limits set by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. They cover ships and coastal emission control areas, also called ECAs or ECAs. Heitz says cleaner fuel is more expensive, and cruise lines will pass that on to customers.
The cost of the ECA on a cruise ticket could be $150, or three times the cost of the Alaska head tax. We lost five big ships because of the head tax. By extrapolation, will we lose 15 ships?
Skagway's assembly passed a resolution Heitz asked for by a unanimous vote. It calls for state officials to fight the new requirement, which lowers sulfur dioxide emissions within 200 miles of shore. The Northern Lynn Canal community is not alone. Haines and Sitka are among other towns passing similar resolutions. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan also issued a statement saying the rules could impact barge traffic, and U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski took to her chamber's floor to point out that rural Alaska would see the highest price hikes from more expensive shipping.
The EPA's one-size-fits-all approach to environmental regulation, perhaps you can't quite shoehorn that in all situations.
The statements and resolutions came after the Parnell administration sued the EPA and other federal agencies to block or amend the rules. The industry is also fighting the federal government. Alaska Cruise Association President John Binkley says ships might shift to other countries that don't require the strict limits.
Alaska is an expensive destination because there are long distances to travel, so fuel becomes a much more important component of the overall cost of the ship.
The EPA wouldn't provide anyone for an interview, but a press release from the agency says sulfur pollution from bunker fuel used by cruise ships and some barge lines has been linked to respiratory illnesses. It says children, the elderly, and asthmatics are among those most at risk. Some Alaskans support that approach.
Compared to having a tremendous amount of air pollution in Alaska waters, I think that it's worth it.
Gershon Cohen is a Haines Clean Water and Air activist who's been involved in cruise ship issues.
It's not going to come out of the cruise industry's pocket one way or another. They're going to pass that cost on to consumers, and for the thousands that the consumers are spending, I don't think they're really going to ever notice.
Canada and a number of other nations are already imposing the new standards, which are part of an international treaty. Opponents worry that impacts will be far worse in 2015. That's when the EPA will further limit fuel sulfur content by a factor of 10. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Scientists say a type of bird flu, H3N8, is responsible for the death of more than 160 harbor seals on the East Coast. Reports of sick seals began in September, which coincided with the reports of diseased seals in Alaska's northern coasts. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin reports there is no relation between the avian flu on the East Coast and the disease affecting ice seals and walrus in Alaska.
Rafaela Stimmelmeyer is a research biologist for the North Slope Department of Wildlife Management. She's also the on-site coordinator for the unusual mortality event on ice seals and Pacific walrus in Alaska, and says from the beginning she's worked closely with the investigative teams working on the New England harbor seal cases. She says the bird flu that killed the New England harbor seals is not what is killing seals in Alaska.
The Yumi seals on the Alaska side were actually tested for that early on to rule out that there was no relationship between the East Coast unusual mortality event and the Alaska unusual mortality event.
The New England harbor seals displayed skin lesions and had severe pneumonia and were found along the coast from Maine to Massachusetts. Stimmelmeyer says while there are similarities between the illnesses, like skin lesions on the flippers, there are also differences.
They did not show any of the facial lesions that we would be seeing or the lesions around the snout. These seals over there actually had fulminant pneumonias, and that's actually what we have not seen in our seals.
Researchers are still trying to figure out what's making the seals and walrus sick in Alaska. Stimmelmeyer says they're currently working on ruling out viruses and other causes for the illness.
We don't have a smoking gun right now. I think based on hunter observation, it is a new disease syndrome that we were observing, because based on traditional knowledge as well as communication from the hunters, they had never seen anything like this before.
And the researchers have not ruled out the radionuclei dispersed from the Fukushima nuclear accident as the cause. While a qualitative screening was done early on that told researchers that the diseased seals in Alaska were not carrying large loads of radionuclides, it's not enough to rule radiation out. Stimmelmeyer says they are now looking at whether the diseased seals carried cesium-134 and 137. Cesium-137 is and has been present in the environment throughout the world from nuclear testing done in the 1960s and 70s. Cesium-134 is the signature radionuclide that was released during the Fukushima accident.
We do not think at this point that it is, related to that. But I think one truly has to wait until we have the quantitative numbers to be able to say, no, there is no trace in these animals. And then we confidently can say there is no relationship.
And regarding the Alaska unusual mortality event on ice seals and Pacific walrus, Stimmelmeyer says they have not observed or seen new cases. As the UME on-site coordinator, she says they should be coming out with a regional update in mid-August. Diseased seals in Alaska were first reported last summer. The research for the New England UME on harbor seals was published in the journal M. Bio. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Chickaloon Village drummers and singers warmed up the crowd today for the ribbon cutting on South Central Foundation's new Valley Native Primary Care Clinic in Wasilla. Alaska Native leaders, state and borough officials, and a few hundred members of the public gathered inside the spacious atrium of the new clinic to mark the opening later this month of Bent'a Nuta, the clinic's native name, which means among lakes and islands. The new facility was built to meet the primary health care needs of the 9,000 Alaska Natives living in the Matanuska Susitna Borough. By next year, the clinic expects to have 8,500 customers. The project was built in collaboration with the Chickaloon and Kinnick tribes. Gary Harrison is chief of the Chickaloon Village Traditional Council.
It's been a long time coming, and it's been a collaboration with a lot of different people, and it's sometimes hard to coordinate several organizations and all of that to make it happen, but it finally come together and it's here.
South Central Foundation is the nonprofit healthcare arm of Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, which manages some 65 healthcare programs and services. The New Valley facility is an 84,000 square foot building offering primary, dietary, behavioral health, and pharmacy services. Others, such as dental and optometry, will be phased in under an agreement with the Indian Health Service. The facility opens its doors on August 29th. The Middle Kuskokwim village of Tuathpaluk is known for its beautiful mountains and dense spruce trees. The village and surrounding area has a rich history of subsisting off the land. But as KYUK's Mark Earhart found out, that subsistence culture might be fading.
In Yupik, Tuathpaluk means the place of big blueberries. But many locals just call it Chewy. For a village of just over 100, Chewy has lots of roads. They stretch over town, crisscrossing up the steep hillsides. If you're visiting, you're likely to be offered a ride on the back of a four-wheeler up one of the steep grades. That's how I met Eric Morgan Sr.
Hey, watch what your grandfathers teach him. See?
Morgan shows me his stack of uncut wood. He says elders taught him to gather lumber and other resources. He pulls out his key ring in front of his smokehouse door. There's a full moose rack hanging just above our heads.
That's how I've learned from my grandfathers. I got the cycle. As soon as I'm done with fish, this is next. As soon as I'm done with this, berries.
Inside the smokehouse, the afternoon sunshine beams in from the space in the walls. Strips of drying salmon hang in balance from the ceiling. Morgan wasn't born with the knowledge of how to smoke fish or what berries to pick.
I learned from what they teach me as I was growing up, and I try to teach my grandkids the same thing.
But Morgan says these days, some are losing their subsistence culture.
Nowadays, nobody wants to do anything no more. We try to teach them. And
the next generation, I don't think they'll be even... They don't even know how to cut fish or put up strips or jar fish.
Sophie Sakar is a village elder. She shows me pieces of her family's past as we stand in her living room. She's worried about village children losing traditional subsistence knowledge.
Some of them, they get food stamps. They get their kids anything. All the junk food that they eat now. When I was growing up, we didn't have those stuff.
This is a world where gas creeps up over $7 a gallon, and you are hard-pressed to find any type of fresh produce at the store.
That's why I don't go for food stamps, to teach my grandkids how to try and survive on their own.
To some, Chewy might look bleak, as many in the village have seemingly forgotten how to subsist off the land. But to Sakar, Morgan, and others, there are still wonderful resources around them.
My individual family, my son came all the way from Fairbanks, 17 years old. He spent a lot of time out there drifting, and I was very proud of him.
That's resident Helen Kwame.
And because of that, I always believe that whatever you reap, you sow, and he was able to bring fish home with him.
Kwame says she made sure she had her children in tow when subsisting off the land. They grew up knowing how to cut fish and gather berries, not depending on public assistance or sugary foods from the stores. Maybe through her and the others' efforts, the tide is starting to turn here in Tswathpalluk. I'm Mark Earhart.
The Wrangell Cooperative Association is looking into the feasibility of another new economic outlet for Wrangell's wood mills and forests. They want to use wood waste to heat the community's homes and government buildings by making wood chip boilers and bio bricks. KSTK's Ann Hillman joined forester Bill Wall for a look at the community's potential.
Bill Wall walks up to the looming pile of wood chips that's been sitting at the old Silver Bay mill site for more than 4 years and sinks in his hand.
Ooh. There's your answer. Look how wet that is.
And it's the moisture content that matters when turning wood waste into efficiently burning biobricks. A biobrick is sort of what it sounds like, a highly compressed, dried-out wood waste that's packed into a cleaner-burning, energy-efficient, brick-shaped chunk. Unlike wood pellets that require special equipment to burn, the bricks are used in place of firewood in a typical wood-burning stove. The key here is that the wood has to be dry. Wall explains that it's the moisture that makes firewood burn inefficiently.
If you have 40 pounds of wood, which would be an armload of wood, and you're going to put it in a wood stove, and it was cut green and it just seasoned a very little bit, so it's 40% moisture, it's the same as taking that wood and setting it in the stove with 2 full-gallon jugs of water.
With biobricks, it would be more like 4 cups of water, a significant difference. Okay, so what's the big deal? Can't you just dry the wood chips out? Mill operator Jim Collier says in this climate, it's not that easy to dry out wood and to keep it dry.
In a kiln, if you take it down to 12% or 10% or 8% even, somewhere in the ballpark area. Take it out of the kiln and put it in a dry shed, unheated. It will actually, in this country here, go back up to about 18 or 20%.
Right.
So herein lies one of Wall's biggest questions. Given how wet Wrangell is, would it be worth it to create biobricks?
Pellets or biobricks, either one, require energy added in order to make the product. And that is part of the feasibility study, is to look at and see if it makes sense to add that energy to then make that product, and make that product much more efficient than just firewood.
To complete the study, Wall took samples of wood and wood chips from every waste site on the island he could access. The samples will be sent to a lab to test for the moisture content and their BTUs. Some of the older wood may not have enough energy left in it to be worth burning.
Once you chip it and you put it in a pile, it starts composting. And that microbial and chemical breakdown just creates less BTUs.
So if the massive piles of chips and sawdust at the old mill site are too far gone to burn, will there be enough biomass? Mike Allen stands by a towering stack of wood waste at his mill.
We started running the mill again last Monday, so this is like 6 days, 7 days worth of sawn is this pile here.
In just a week, the stack is built much higher than his head and extends back about two tree lengths. When milling, he has to throw out any pieces with defects because they can't be sold. Some people haul the waste for firewood, but the rest is just burnt. Allen estimates he produces about 1,500 tons of green waste per year. To run a biobrick plant, you need about 3,500 tons. Wall says that could be an issue.
The number one thing you have to have in any biomass project is you've got to have a sustainable supply of a material that you know is of the quality that you need to go into the process.
But if biobricks don't work out, the wood could still be chipped and used to heat municipal buildings.
For instance, we could be heating the elementary school, the hospital, the Forest Service building, perhaps even the middle school and the high school with one boiler.
And for the boiler, the chips could be at 45 to 50% moisture. For the biobricks, the wood needs to be about 10% moisture. Wall says one advantage of both products is they keep money in Wrangell.
Keeping funds in your community and paying yourself for creating energy versus paying out of the community for energy.
The study is funded by a grant from Alaska Village Initiatives and should be completed in the fall. In Wrangell, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Mark Earhart in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Wrangell. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with MyPFD info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.